Oft in one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located halfway between Hogtown and the Motor City in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's quote is by the 19th century poet John Keats, written on the occasion of his first reading of Homer's Iliad, as translated into English by George Chapman. The Iliad tells the story of the Greek conquest of the city of Troy, a conflict aided and abetted by the actions of the mythological gods after whom the planets of the solar system are named. Appropriately, our accompanying music tonight is James Horner's Troy, from the 2004 movie of the same name. As for the two warring sides, they too have been immortalized in our planetary firmament. 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind, in the orbit of any planet, is a little gravitational Sargasso Sea, where asteroids can accumulate. The largest concentrations of this solar system flotsam can be found, not surprisingly, on the orbit of Jupiter, where the leading group is called the Greeks, and the trailing group is called the Trojans. Both are doomed to revolve around the sun, minor pieces of rock and ice chasing one another on Jupiter's puppeteering strings for all of time. Now, why am I talking about Troy tonight? The reason is that we have with us a very special guest, Paul Wiegert. You see, Jupiter isn't the only world to possess Trojan asteroids. Recently, Paul was part of a team that discovered Earth's very first Trojan, an achievement that was documented in the magazine Nature. Currently, Paul is a professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at Western University, and his research interests extend to all of celestial mechanics, be it small bodies, meteor streams, or systems of planets around other stars. Western World's own Tyler August sat down with Paul recently to talk to him about his discovery and how small objects move around in our solar system.
You've been in the news recently for a specific asteroid. You want to tell us about this, why this asteroid is special?
That's right, Tyler. The discovery involves a new near-Earth asteroid, which you can probably tell from its name, involves an asteroid which gets nearer to the Earth than is typical of them. But what was particularly interesting about this one was its relationship with the Earth, in that it actually shares the Earth's orbit safely with it in a way that other asteroids typically don't.
So it's going around on Earth's orbit, sort of offset, if I'm right. So this is what we call a Trojan asteroid, correct?
That's right. Trojan is one of the subclasses of what we call a co-orbital asteroid. And a co-orbital asteroid is an asteroid which shares, essentially, a planet's orbit with it. And so maybe the way to picture it is the Earth is going around the sun. Maybe we can imagine that it's a blue car going around on a circular racetrack. So the Earth is traveling around the circular racetrack, and there are other asteroids which occasionally zip across the track. These are not the ones we're interested in. But co-orbital asteroid is an asteroid which actually drives around on the same track with the Earth and yet manages to avoid any collisions. And so it's this sort of particular relationship where the asteroid is traveling around in roughly the same track as the Earth is, but manages to avoid ever getting close enough to smack into us, which is a good thing.
Okay, so I'm picturing a NASCAR race here. So who's winning?
Well, nobody's winning because it's a round track and there's no finish line. But the Earth's going around at a nice steady speed, as it will. The asteroid is, however, being a little bit, maybe erratic is not the right word for it, but the asteroid doesn't keep exactly the same pace as the Earth. So you can imagine that if they're both driving around this circular racetrack and they're not colliding, then either the asteroid is traveling at exactly the same speed as the Earth around the track, which actually doesn't occur, though it's a theoretical possibility, or the asteroid actually accelerates and decelerates at various times to avoid colliding with the Earth. And that's actually what the asteroid does.
That sounds like a pretty smart asteroid.
Well, the asteroid's not that smart. It could be if there was somebody driving the car, but all of this is actually determined by the laws of physics and orbital mechanics. And so it's just a natural result of the interplay of gravity and momentum in the solar system.
So right now, is this asteroid ahead of us or behind us on the orbit?
Well, this asteroid is ahead of us. And in fact, because of its nature, it will always remain ahead of us. And so a Trojan asteroid is an asteroid which always remains either ahead of or behind the planet in its orbit. And so this particular asteroid, whose name happens to be, well, actually, it doesn't have a name yet. It only has a designation, but its designation is 2010 TK7, and so we sometimes refer to it as TK7 for short. So TK7 is always ahead of us in the track. Sometimes it speeds up and pulls ahead of us until it almost gets 180 degrees ahead of us in the track. And then at that point, again, the laws of physics and gravity cause it to slow down. The Earth starts to catch up with it, if you will, until the asteroid gets relatively close to us, at which point it accelerates again and pulls ahead.
Which is a little bit counterintuitive. We might be imagining if it gets closer to the Earth's gravity would draw it inwards. Could you briefly explain why that doesn't happen?
Briefly, no. But you're right, it is counterintuitive. You would think that an asteroid that's getting closer and closer to the Earth would inevitably get caught in the Earth's gravity and pulled in with some unfortunate effects afterwards. But it turns out that though the Earth's gravity certainly acts on the asteroid, it pulls it in such a way that not only does it get closer to the Earth, but it actually speeds up. And so this is actually the result of a conservation of what we call angular momentum. Not easy to explain over the radio. But the net result is that even though the Earth is actually pulling the asteroid towards it, the asteroid is also, again, counterintuitively, being sped up by the Earth, and that's what allows it to accelerate.
So can we think of this a little bit like the slingshot effect, which our listeners might be familiar with?
It's a little bit like the slingshot effect, in the sense that momentum and angular momentum is being transferred from the planet to the asteroid. So the slingshot effect is an effect which is often used in planetary missions, whereby a spacecraft can be swung around a planet and launched onto a different, perhaps faster trajectory if the approach trajectory is chosen appropriately. And so in some sense, the Trojan nature of this asteroid is similar. I would say that it's different in a couple of technical key ways, which maybe we don't need to get into here, but it's essentially an interaction between the planet and the asteroid, which gives the asteroid the boost it needs to go where it's going.
Okay, so you mentioned slingshotting spacecraft. While we're on the topic, I'll ask, do you think this TK7 is a good prospect for visiting with a probe, or even NASA's been looking at sending a mission to a near-Earth asteroid? Since this one is physically, you say, very close, would this be a good candidate?
Yes and no. These co-orbital asteroids like TK7 do have the obvious advantage of staying near the Earth's orbit. They don't go whizzing off tremendously far into the solar system, and so they have that practical advantage. However, TK7 itself is actually not the easiest to get to by spacecraft. So if you were to try to get there from the Earth, the key parameter that you're interested in is the amount of delta V that you would require to get there. So the change in velocity that your spacecraft needs, which is a key which determines how much fuel you need, essentially, and that's a key constraint. And so TK7 is on the short list of asteroids with relatively low delta V. Maybe it's in the top 10%, but some details of the orbit, in particular the fact that it's somewhat inclined, actually mean that it's not at the top of the list. So it has some advantages in terms of human exploration or even robotic exploration. But it's not the easiest to get to in terms of raw economics of fuel.
Okay. Now, we know how big this one is.
We have an estimate. We don't have any particularly good pictures of it, and so it has been seen, but at what we might call extremely low resolution. We can't see any detail on the surface, but we can estimate how big it is from the amount of light it reflects. And so It's rather large, or it's on the larger side for a near-Earth asteroid, clocking in at somewhere between 300 and 400 meters in diameter.
Okay, so it's a large asteroid, and it's a close asteroid. So why haven't we seen it until now?
Well, if we go back to our analogy of the racetrack, the circular racetrack runs around the sun. And so the Earth drives around the sun, and so does the asteroid. But if the asteroid is always on the racetrack with the Earth, it spends most of its time close to the sun, if you want to think of it as the daytime side of the Earth. So the sun shines on one side of the Earth, that's where it's daytime, and if the asteroid is in that part of the sky, then it's very, very difficult to see. You can't see things very well even with a telescope because of the bright blue daytime sky. And so the nature of these asteroids tends to keep them very, very much in the daytime sky where they're difficult to see. In fact, this one was only seen under rather unusual circumstances. It was originally detected by NASA's WISE spacecraft, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which was taking images from space where the blue sky in the daytime is less of an issue, and that's actually where it was initially detected.
So some of our viewers might not know this, but Canada is launching a similar, in some ways, space telescope, hopefully this year, called NEOSAT, Near Earth Object Satellite something tracking. I'm not exactly sure of the full acronym, but it's a mission to look for these sorts of objects. And I believe you're in some way involved in this. I think I saw your name on one of the... So is this, well, one, NEOSAT going to help us find more of these Trojans, which are the nice, happy, close asteroids, and give us any details you feel like sharing on this mission that you have handy?
Sure. So the NEOSAT mission, I'm not quite sure exactly what it stands for either, but it's something along the line of Near Earth Orbit Survey Satellite, something like that. And it is a Canadian mission, an entirely Canadian mission, to put up a small telescope. We're talking here about tens of centimeters in diameter, so this is not a giant telescope by any means, a small telescope. Putting it up into orbit where you can get around the disadvantages of the atmosphere and the effects of daytime and so forth. And the primary mission of this telescope is actually to look for asteroids which are close to the sun in what would be the daytime part of the sky if you were down on Earth. Well, it still is technically the daytime part of the sky, but from space you can minimize some of the unfortunate effects that the sun has on astronomical observing. And so the NEOSAT mission is designed to be able to look for objects quite close into the sun, as much as 45 or 40 degrees from the sun itself, using a complicated set of baffles to keep sunlight from reflecting down onto the sensitive detector. So this mission is slated to launch in 2012, this year, on an Indian launcher, though it hasn't officially, the launch date has not officially been set yet. There are still, I think, two more launches that have to go, or maybe one launch that has to go before this one. Yeah, so hopefully within a year or so, we'll have our own Canadian asteroid detecting telescope in space.
And how small down in size will this one be able to, like, with WISE, you found a several hundred meter. Could NEOSAT do better?
NEOSAT might be able to do better. Of course, it's a question of exactly how close the asteroid is to us. The closer it is to us, the brighter it appears. And so most of the asteroids that we expect NEOSAT to discover will actually be further away than TK7, just because of the way the asteroids are distributed in the solar system. But we should be able to find reasonably small asteroids, so sub-kilometer-size asteroids. But there is some variation with their actual distance from us in the solar system.
So this will help with the planetary defense mission, finding the hazardous ones. This will be charting a part of the sky where they could come at us out of the sun, as the Red Baron used to do.
Exactly. That's one of the last really unexplored regions of the solar system in terms of asteroids. As you mentioned, an asteroid which would be coming at us roughly from the direction of the sun would be extremely difficult to detect, even with a very, very large and powerful telescope, simply because the sky is too bright in the daytime. And so the NEOSAT mission will help reduce that risk by finding a lot of these asteroids which are really undetectable by current techniques.
Well, wonderful. I'll stop worrying then.
Hopefully you weren't too worried to begin with.
Oh, but it keeps me up every night. So, do we know, or do we have any idea what TK7 might be made of?
The answer is no, not really. We don't expect that it's particularly different from any other near-Earth asteroids, and so I should specify that near-Earth asteroids and these co-orbital asteroids are interesting or different from ordinary asteroids because of their behavior, because of their dynamics, but not necessarily because of their composition. So we don't necessarily expect these things to be made of anything different than other near-Earth asteroids are made of. And so, though we don't have any information on the composition of TK7, at the moment we expect it to be a garden-variety asteroid.
So some mixture of rock and metal. And
that's right. Asteroids do come in a number of different flavors, from the rocky through the metallic through the possibly icy. Some asteroids are now becoming to be suspected to have more ice aboard them than was originally thought. But at this point, we don't know what TK7 is specifically made of.
For that, I suppose we would need a spectrograph.
That's right. So you can tell what an asteroid is made of, at least roughly, by looking at the color it is. And so the details of the color tell you quite a bit about what the asteroid looks like. But as of this moment, there hasn't been any spectroscopy done of the asteroid, and so we don't really have any information on that yet.
For our listeners, a spectrograph, just imagine a prism, breaks down into the colors of the rainbow. By measuring the brightness of that rainbow at different points, you can tell more or less what the material is. The best example is neon lamps. Neon glows orange, and depending on what other gases you add to it, you can get different color glows. And it's the same for reflectance spectra, which obviously the asteroid isn't glowing, I would imagine.
No.
So it's interesting because it's dynamically different from the, you know, quote-unquote average asteroid. So the average asteroid, that's just hanging out in between Mars and Jupiter in the main belt, right?
That's right. So everybody knows that the asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter, and that's where the bulk of the solar system's asteroids live. The near-Earth asteroids are actually a small subpopulation of these asteroids which have escaped from the asteroid belt. And so the asteroids in the asteroid belt go around happily for millions or billions of years, but the slow effect of the planets, in particular Jupiter, eventually caused them to leave the asteroid belt. They can actually either go further out into the solar system or towards the inner solar system, but obviously the near-Earth asteroids are the ones that have gotten closer to the sun. And so these escapees can mill around in the vicinity of the Earth. Obviously, they do pose at least a potential impact hazard. And some small fraction of these near-Earth asteroids can be trapped into these co-orbital orbits.
So do we have any idea how they get stuck, you know, on our track, as it were? I mean, you say the Earth's gravity keeps them sort of stably around us once they're in our orbit, but isn't it more likely that they're going to be grabbed by our gravity again? And just intuitively, I'm thinking, if the Earth's gravity grabs them, it's more likely they're going to get sucked in and collide with us than get tossed onto one of these lovely co-orbital paths, such as TK7 is on.
Well, the process by which they get to these orbits is actually fairly complicated. And it's different for the Earth than for some of the other planets. For example, planet Jupiter is the canonical example of a planet with these Trojan asteroids. So TK7 is the first Trojan asteroid known for the Earth, but Jupiter has thousands of them and has been known to have them for well over 100 years now. Jupiter is thought to have captured those Trojan asteroids at the time that it formed. The Earth may have captured Trojan asteroids when it formed, but we don't think that TK7 actually dates from the time of the solar system's formation. That would be quite exciting if it did. But it turns out that the Earth is insufficiently massive to hold on to its Trojan asteroids indefinitely in the face of all the perturbations that exist in the solar system. And so asteroids like TK7 get temporarily captured through a slightly complicated process, which is not easy to describe on the radio, but it does involve interacting with the Earth's gravity and the gravity of the other planets in the solar system. It gets trapped into this state temporarily. TK7 will probably exist in this state for something like 10,000 years before it escapes and returns to the background near-Earth asteroid population, if you will.
So we're only safe from this one for 10,000 years, then. After that, we can start worrying again.
That's right. After that, all bets are off.
So if they're only in there temporary, we don't expect to find many of these Earth Trojans, do we?
No. It requires a fairly specific set of circumstances for these things to be produced. And we expect that there are perhaps a handful, perhaps, say, 10 asteroids of any size in the vicinity, either of the leading Trojan point or the trailing Trojan point. I mentioned that Trojans can either be in the front half or the back half of the Earth's orbit. And we expect to find somewhere around a dozen of these at any given time.
So it's not a very, going back to the racetrack analogy, it's not a crowded racetrack, at least not this particular portion. Of course, the crossing, the analogy breaks down when you get into it. Turns into a very crazy racetrack, one of those strange Formula One ones, but
that's right.
It might get a little more crowded on the crossings, but at least on our orbit, it's fairly open then.
That's right. We don't expect that there's going to be a tremendous number of asteroids sharing our orbit. I should mention that Trojan is actually just one of three possible co-orbital states which can exist, and it would be a little bit, again, complicated to try to explain the differences between them all over the radio, but in total we don't expect
Google
more.
It, folks.
That's right, you can Google it. But we don't expect that there are more than, well, you know, perhaps at most 100, but probably only a few tens of these asteroids in total on the Earth's orbit.
And aside from TK, how many do we know of?
Well, we know of four so far in various degrees of co-orbitalness with the Earth. Some of them are quite temporary. Others are more secure and stable. The first one discovered for the Earth was an asteroid which is now called asteroid 3753 Carinia, which is Carinia being the name of a Celtic tribe in the original Gaelic, and it was named by its discoverer.
Is that going to be the naming scheme now? Normally, when we find an asteroid population, or any population of anything in the astronomy, we tend to adopt some kind of naming convention. So the Trojans, for example, I just want to be clear for all the 17-year-old boys in the audience who are giggling away at this. It's not named after a brand of condoms. This goes back 100 years, and they're named after characters in the Trojan War from Homer, the ancient Greek poet's Iliad. And so there's Hector and Pactolus and all these wonderful old Greek names. So are we going to go with Celtic names now for these co-orbitals? Is that a possibility?
It's certainly a possibility, I suppose. You're right, the very first Trojan discoverer was named Achilles, and since then all the Trojan asteroids of Jupiter have been named after heroes of the Greek and Trojan War. Co-orbitals for the Earth, there is only the one which is named, this Carinia, which has a Celtic name. There has not yet been any official pattern adopted, and so we don't know exactly how this is going to go. It's quite possible, but the unpronounceability of some of the Gaelic names to those of us of a plain vanilla English background has a few people wondering if maybe we shouldn't perhaps go in a different direction. But it would be nice to have some kind of a consistent naming scheme for these asteroids, but it hasn't been laid out yet.
So how close do these co-orbital asteroids get to the Earth? You're right, it is hard to pronounce. Carthune, Carithin, or TK7?
Well, most of them stay actually at quite a distance from the Earth, which is why we consider them to be quite safe. So none of them get closer than about 10 times the distance to the Moon. So the Moon's about 384,000 kilometers from us, so they're all sort of several million kilometers from us at the closest, which is well outside what is considered a close approach. In terms of near-Earth asteroids. But even TK7 doesn't get any closer to us than about 20 million kilometers. And so even at its closest approach, when the Earth, if we go back to our racetrack analogy, when the two cars are closest together, we're still 20 million kilometers from a collision.
So we're not drafting.
No, we're not particularly close. There's not really much danger of scratching each other's paint.
Well, I'll definitely sleep better at night then for that. I think that's pretty much all the time we have with Dr. Wiegert, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Tyler, for having me.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion. Joining me here today, we've got Tyler August, Parshadi Patel, and Raymond Francis. Why don't we start off with Tyler? What was it that really captivated you during that interview with Paul?
He didn't tell me, not a word, before the Nature publication. I found out about it when it was on the cover of the magazine. And so that sort of, I'd been waiting to bug him about it as well.
Oh, that's impressive. You're a student of his, aren't you?
Yes, yeah.
So even in science, sometimes we keep things under wraps, even from our own students.
It's important, if you want to get on the cover, to make sure that you're the first, and so that there can be no leaks. Three can keep a secret if two of them are dead.
Ah, that does help. This was one of the first Trojan asteroids, or was it the first?
The first for the Earth.
The first for the Earth. But other planets are well known to have plenty of these. I mean, the Trojans refers mainly to Jupiter originally.
Yeah,
as Paul was saying in the interview, there's some thousands of Trojan asteroids, Jupiter, and a handful around other planets known, a couple around Mars, I believe, and Saturn has, I think, two or three confirmed.
Oh, so not very many for things that are not Jupiter.
Well, Saturn is very far out. It's hard to see, and the asteroids are very small. And so at that distance, the sun's light is very weak, and by the time it bounces off the asteroid and back to us, your chances of seeing anything are fairly low. That would be my excuse for Saturn. Also, Saturn and Mars, being on either side of Jupiter, will feel its influences. So any asteroid that might want to, so to speak, fall under the influence of Mars or Saturn is more likely to be bumped out by Jupiter than staying on that lane of the racetrack, to use Paul's analogy.
Now, with Jupiter, we've got the Trojans and the Greeks. Does that distinction get made anywhere else?
No. In general, the overall designation has become Trojan, even though, yes, for Jupiter we have one camp which has Trojan names and one camp which has Greek names. Thus far, have adopted Trojan for any asteroid which exhibits this characteristic, and they'll each get different population names as they're populated. There aren't enough asteroids encamped, as it were, around any other planet to actually warrant a name yet. But I guarantee you, whatever they come up with for Earth will start with A. All near-Earth asteroid groups so far have had an A name. There's the Apollos, Amors, and Aten, which are just further out, crossing Earth's orbit, and just inside, if I get the order right.
Are there any prospective names?
Not that I know of, but I'm sure there's something floating around out there. My vote is for Athenians. I'll just put that on record.
Very nice.
So, what I really liked about this interview was the fact that this is the first Trojan asteroid that is actually being discovered, and it has been done by the member of the CPSX and a professor here at Western. What I also like that we are now launching another satellite that is going to be Canadian satellite that is actually going to help discover other asteroids. Probably something more to be done at Western. It'll all be work of Paul and probably his students.
Well, in part at Western. The principal investigators for NEOSAT are, I believe, at University of Calgary.
Okay.
So, but we're on the team.
Paul, yes.
Paul Wiegert and Peter Brown, and somehow I think Oz got himself wrangled in there because Oz does everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have had some success with some small satellites in Canada, for instance, MOST.
Actually, the NEOSAT is based on the MOST platform, MOST being a small stellar observation satellite.
Yes, the nickname that we have for it is the Humble Telescope.
But the success of MOST and hopefully of NEOSAT, as highlighted in the interview here, it suggests the utility of not just space missions for finding asteroids that you can't see easily from the surface of the Earth, but also of small missions, because both of the mentioned spacecraft, MOST and NEOSAT, have a mass on the order of 100 kilograms and have been and are planned to be launched as sort of secondary backup payloads on larger rockets where larger satellites are going. So for a discount launch on a low price, if you will, mission, you can get a lot. And MOST is now something like 11 years in orbit doing observations.
Still going strong, yeah.
So there are things, as Dr. Wiegert pointed out, that you can do from orbit that you can't easily do from the surface. We may be able to find a lot of these asteroids that are closer to the sun as viewed from here that we wouldn't be able to find. And so we may be able to learn things that you can't get by any other way.
Exactly. Sometimes it's just as simple as the geometry, and that's what MOST really is able to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And like you say, it's really a fascinating use of that small payload. I mean, it's one really just one step above a CubeSat when you get down to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's small enough, you could physically check it as part of your airline luggage to bring it to India to have it launched, which is, I believe, the current plan for NEOSAT is to put it on one of IRAS's, I forget the name of the rocket, but they're very prosaic.
I think it's going
launcher.
Up on a PSLV.
Yeah,
okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And Air Canada over there.
I don't know about that. It's heavier than they'll let you check as luggage.
We can pay the overage fees. It'll be fine.
Maybe, but it's also very sensitive. So, yeah, I mean, it's an easy payload to accommodate on rockets like the PSLV, where you usually have sometimes over a ton of extra capacity on the rocket. And so you can, in fact, that rocket has in the past launched as many as 9 spacecraft at once, a big one and a bunch of little ones tacked in at the bottom. Yeah, in any event, this is a capacity that we can use for finding asteroids and doing other interesting things.
That's very neat. Paul also mentioned going and visiting some of these places. How realistic is that?
With NEOSAT, No.
Well, not now with Neosat, yeah. with its not, own mission.
Yeah, and not with a cheap 100-kilogram mission either. Now, he was talking about the utility of going to this TK7 or somewhere else and how delta V was a key criterion. How much change in velocity you have to do added up over the whole mission to achieve this. Now, it turns out that there are a few asteroids that are about as easy to get to in terms of delta V as the Earth's moon. But after that, they get a lot more expensive. And so it is difficult to get there. It's probably not impossible. And we've had rocks come here from there. So
some of them very large.
Yeah, and some of them with very long transit times, if you want to be patient. So it is perhaps in principle possible, but of course we don't have a spacecraft on hand to do it right now.
And I guess one of the issues is that a lot of the asteroids that will come near to us, it takes a lot of fuel to match their velocity and to actually get to them, even though they might appear to be closer to us than the moon at a particular time. You can't just go and latch on and get a ride, not when you're talking kilometers of a second in either direction.
Well, that's the beauty of a Trojan asteroid, is that it doesn't go whizzing past us at phenomenal speed. So we can take a nice, slow saunter over to it, rather than trying to sprint up to it as it whizzes by at high speed. Imagine a freight train going by, as opposed to TGG. You're not going to catch a ride with it.
Sure, but of course, if you have to have a slow saunter to get someplace, then it takes longer.
Oh, yes.
That means if you're sending people, that means you have to pack more carrots.
Yes.
And this gets heavy, which means you need more fuel. So there's a complicated trade-off to be done to compare all of these asteroids.
So any final thoughts to sum up our discussion in the interview?
Well, I think we had a brief interview with Dr. Wiegert, and we learned that there's several different techniques for finding asteroids. He used data that was a byproduct of an infrared all-sky survey, but his group also has cameras scattered around this part of the country, building up a continuous map of the things that are falling through the atmosphere. And there are even further the possibility of using spacecraft and ground-based telescopes to directly image these things. So there's a lot of ways to do this, and new innovative ways of leveraging those capabilities that are starting to come online. So I think this is interesting that there's such a variety of ways of looking at the same objects.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Tyler August. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and John Moores. Our editors were Tyler August, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/Western Worlds. And as of this week, you can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.